the views of the United States government.
This is VOA News. I'm Christina Menenti. Hurricane Beryl is closing in on the southeastern Caribbean after strengthening into what experts call an extremely dangerous Category 4 storm. National Hurricane Center Director Michael Brennan warns those in Beryl's path to heed all warnings and evacuation orders.
We're most concerned about areas from St. Vincent and the Grenadines south to Grenada, where we could see the core of that Category 4 hurricane move through. When you get to Category 4 strength, you can see things like total roof damage, roofs lifted off of homes, exterior wall collapse, trees uprooted, significant damage, and a complete destruction of power lines and other infrastructure.
Hurricane warnings are in effect for Barbados, St. Lucia, Grenada, Tobago, and St. Vincent and the Grenadines. The National Hurricane Center in Miami warns that Beryl is forecast to bring life-threatening winds and storm surge. Exit polls show on Sunday Marine Le Pen's far-right National Rally Party won the first round of parliamentary elections in France, but the final result will depend on the days of hard bargaining before the second round of voting next week. Reuters correspondent Chris Dingham reports.
A week of tough political decisions now lies ahead. In the past, center-right and center-left parties have teamed up to keep the National Rally from power, but that dynamic is less certain than ever. A longtime pariah, the far-right National Rally is now closer to power than it has ever been. Le Pen has sought to clean up the image of her party. Known for racism and anti-Semitism, her efforts appear to have worked amid voter anger at Macron, the high cost of living, and growing concerns over immigration.
Reuters correspondent Chris Dingham. Former Bolivian President Evo Morales has accused current President Luis Arce of faking this week's coup. In a sharp 180 turn against his former ally-turned-rival on Sunday, Morales joined others who believe Arce himself orchestrated a, quote, self-coup, unquote, to win the sympathy of Bolivians at a time when his popularity is extremely low. AP correspondent Lawrence Brooks explains the coup attempt this week.
La intención era tomar.
In an interview with the Associated Press, the embattled leader denied claims he set up the coup himself to gain political points, and added that the government was investigating if the attack was organized by the country's political opposition.
¿Qué es lo que se está investigando?
Images from Bolivia shocked the world on June 26th as armed troops stormed the government palace in La Paz. Arrests have already been made. In the capital, police held a presentation of a number of detained soldiers accused of staging the coup. Authorities say around 200 military officers took part. I'm Lawrence Brooks.
The lack of reliable electricity is severely affecting education and businesses in Nigeria. Many schools operate in darkness due to zero grid access, depriving students of essential tools like computers. Nationwide, the power crisis leaves about half the population of more than 200 million without electricity, and frequent outages plague even connected areas. Despite abundant solar potential, high financing costs stall some 14 grid-scale solar projects needed to raise the country's electricity capacity. The U.S. Justice Department plans to propose Boeing plead guilty to criminal fraud in connection with two deadly plane crashes involving its 737 MAX jetliners. VOA's Joe Ramsey reports.
Several people who heard prosecutors detail the offer on Sunday say U.S. aircraft maker Boeing will have until the end of the week to accept or reject the offer, which includes agreeing to an independent monitor. Lawyers representing relatives of some of the 346 people who died in the 2018 and 2019 crashes say their clients are dissatisfied with the offer. During the meeting, family members expressed anger. Prosecutors did not plan to pursue additional charges and a trial. Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
North Korea test-fired two ballistic missiles Monday, but one of them possibly flew abnormally, South Korea's military said, a day after the North vowed, quote, offensive and overwhelming, unquote, responses to a new U.S. military drill with South Korea and Japan. The Joint Chiefs of Staff said in a statement the missiles were launched 10 minutes apart in a northeasterly direction from the town of Jangyeon in southeastern North Korea. You'll find expanded coverage of world news and events at our website, voanews.com, 24 hours a day. I'm Christina Menenti. VOA News.
Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Buckley in Washington. Today is Monday, July 1st, and here are some of the stories we are covering. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa announces his Government of National Unity's cabinet.
We've had to ensure that all the parties are able to participate meaningfully in the national executive as well as in various parliamentary positions, and that they should represent the diversity of the people of South Africa properly.
The East African Community lawmakers call for suspension of delinquent member states after budget approval. Amnesty International is concerned about police use of excessive force on peaceful Kenyan protesters. The former leader of the opposition in Uganda's parliament defends receiving a monetary award from President Museveni.
The same way the party elite gets money from the national budget, in the same way a former leader of the opposition at the end of his term was given ex gratia. It is lawful, it was properly processed.
And who will Donald Trump pick for vice president? Those stories, plus Samson Omalley's thoughts, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa has finally announced his cabinet following a month-long negotiation with partners in the Government of National Unity. South Africa's election on May 29th resulted in no outright winner, forcing the ruling African National Congress to negotiate a unity government. Most political parties have welcomed Ramaphosa's cabinet, while analysts have described it as diverse and inclusive. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
President Cyril Ramaphosa announced a bulk cabinet with over 30 ministers, each with a deputy, while some portfolios have two deputy ministers.
We've had to ensure that all the parties are able to participate meaningfully in the national executive, as well as in various parliamentary positions, and that they should represent the diversity of the people of South Africa properly.
Ramaphosa's African National Congress, ANC, is heading key portfolios including minerals and petroleum, electricity and energy, as well as international relations. The sought-after leadership of the Ministry of Finance also went to the ANC, with Finance Minister Enoch Godongwana retaining his position. Political analyst Dyke Kutsiye says this will ensure continuity and restore investor confidence.
Finance and the Treasury are exceptionally important for government in general. Enoch Godongwana is a person who is widely respected amongst the different political parties and internationally also, so which I think will be good for the government in general.
The second largest party in the Government of National Unity, the Democratic Alliance, DA, is in charge of six ministries, with agriculture, basic education and home affairs topping the list. The party has also scored the position of Deputy Minister of Finance. The majority of parties were allocated Deputy Minister positions, while others will head parliamentary committees. Most political parties have welcomed Ramaphosa's cabinet and expressed their commitment to ensure government stability. Ordinary South Africans have expressed different views. A young woman, Busisiwe Gumede, wants the new government to focus on youth issues, create jobs and value education.
The government should find ways in which they can escape the youth from having drugs and keep themselves busy and focus on providing them skills.
Another South African citizen, Then Maphalala Mabunda, is worried that seven parties represented in parliament are still outside the unity government.
It would be a national unity if everybody is inside the tent. Let everybody get inside the tent, and everybody is willing to come inside the tent. Why are you leaving them outside? Because they will be throwing stones from outside.
The country's third largest party, Umkhonto weSizwe, led by former President Jacob Zuma, and the fourth largest economic freedom fighters, are amongst the seven parties outside the new government. The ANC says talks to bring them in are still in progress. For VOA News, this is Tuso Kumalo in Johannesburg.
Mauritanian President Mohamed Ould Ghazouani has won the country's presidential election according to provisional results from over 99.27% of polling stations released on Sunday by the West African Nations Electoral Commission. Ghazouani was re-elected in the Saturday election with over 56% of the vote. The results come from 4,468 polling stations out of 4,503 shown on Mauritania's Independent Electoral Commission's website. Reuters reports analysts had expected Ghazouani, who faced six challengers in the election, to win the race in the first round, thanks to Mauritania's ruling party dominance. The provisional results show that his main rival, anti-slavery activist Biram Dar Abe, was second with 22.14%, followed by Hamadi Sidi El Moukta of the Islamist Tawassul Party with 12.8%. Amnesty International says it is concerned about the increasing number of abductions in Kenya and the excessive use of force by police on peaceful protesters. The group says as many as 24 protesters were killed during the recent anti-tax protests. Meanwhile, President William Ruto, speaking to local media on Sunday, said he fears the good intentions of the youth had been hijacked by criminal elements. Irungu Hector is the executive director of Amnesty International Kenya. He tells me the protests are a consequence of the government's failure to listen to suggestions made about the Finance Bill 2024 before it was approved by Parliament.
At Amnesty International, we've been very concerned primarily with, I guess, two or three areas. First of all, we did prepare and submit a memorandum to the Finance Committee, particularly pointing out that the taxation bill and the budget did not seem to have enough allocation for the right to health, education, and also issues to do with, I guess, basic needs, food security and agriculture. We were also very concerned about the provision that was in the taxation bill that sought to remove the Kenya Revenue Authority from the oversight of the Data Protection Act, which essentially would have brought in mass surveillance of everybody's smartphones to their online money accounts and their bank accounts as well. We also have had major concerns with the way that the right to assembly has been managed by the police. In many instances, we've seen mass arrests, we've seen abductions and detentions without essentially providing medical assistance or access by families or by lawyers. And the third area has been really the violence that we've seen on the streets of Nairobi and about 20 other cities and towns across the country.
What did you hear back from the government when you made the suggestion that you feel that the tax bill did not include certain provisions?
Well, you know, the submissions are essentially, you know, advisory in the sense that you make your submissions, they thank you for them, and then they move to the next set of submissions. So there's no dialogue. And I think this is part of the problem, is that people have got frustrated with this form of public participation that seems to be simply useless in the sense that you make representation and nothing changed. And I think what we've seen is an explosion of real frustration that the government is not listening to the population. And I think that's what caused the mass protests that we've seen throughout the country.
What does Amnesty know? Because it's not clear how many people died, how many people have been wounded, or how many people have been hospitalized. What, are you following this also?
Yes, we are. You know, as of Sunday, the 30th of June, we have verified 24 deaths, 627 arrests, and about 361 serious people injured, ranging from soft tissue to fractured bones. In many cases, some serious injuries in that case. A worrying sign has been the abductions of people by officers that are not wearing uniforms. In many cases, they don't have their service tags, they don't introduce themselves, nor are people told what the charges are. They're simply bundled into unmarked vehicles and taken to different police stations. And in many cases, the police stations are not accessible to lawyers or family members. And in that instance, we've seen about 33 abductions, including the abduction of a member of parliament today, that is Sunday.
Irungu Houghton is the executive director of Amnesty International Kenya. He was speaking with us from Nairobi. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, July 1st. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The East African Legislative Assembly is calling for countries that have failed to pay their yearly dues to be sanctioned. The move comes after the Regional Assembly approved the community's budget on the eve of the deadline. Moses Xavier Rimana reports from Arusha.
After the community was hit by a financial crisis that led to the East African Legislative Assembly and the East African Court of Justice to suspend their activities due to lack of funds in May, the Regional Assembly passes the community's budget of $114 million ahead of the deadline on June 30th each financial year. However, the budget process was mired this year with calls for sanctioning member states that have failed to remit funds. Fatuma Ndangiza is a regional lawmaker from Rwanda.
We don't want to have another community collapsing because there is no funding. We have Article 143 on sanctions. Why don't you apply sanctions?
Article 146 of the Treaty Establishing the East African Community indicates that the summit may suspend a partner state from taking part of the activities of the community if the state fails to observe and fulfill the EAC's fundamental principles, including the failure to meet financial commitments. DRC remains the biggest defaulter now, owing the community more than $21 million. The country is yet to pay any funds since joining the community 2 years ago. David Sankok is a regional lawmaker from Kenya.
It is very important that every state contribute. When you get a salary, you get an allowance, and you know that there is no taxpayers from your country. It is taxpayers from other countries. I have a duty, an obligation to protect the taxpayers of Kenya and the taxes of Kenya.
The chairman of the Council of Ministers, who is South Sudan Minister of East African Community Affairs, Deng Alor Kuol, says that DRC had internal issues and it's willing to pay.
They had to solve some internal issues, and I think they have managed to do that. And they are not leaving this region. And I want to advise that do not try to create a situation where somebody will try to take wrong decisions.
The newly appointed East African Community Secretary General, Veronica Nduva, called on the lawmakers to be patient and that DRC will meet its obligation.
There are three financial years in a nutshell, and they will make good their promise. And I was very convinced by the conversation we had, including inviting us to their capital to meet His Excellency President Tshisekedi. We are convinced, and as the chair says, let us give that country the benefit of what they say, and we stand together with them, and we continue to encourage them to meet their costs.
Member states that form the East African Community increased from 6 to now 8 member states in the last 2 years after the joining of DRC and Somalia. 60% of the community's annual budget this year will be contributed by member states, while 39% will come from development partners. Moses Aviarimana, VOA Africa, Arusha, Tanzania.
The former leader of the opposition in the Ugandan parliament says he has the pedigree to run for president and that those criticizing him are doing so because they fear his potential success. Matthias Mpuuga says Uganda is looking for future leaders and he will decide whether to run in 2026 after consulting his supporters. He was suspended from the National Unity Platform NUP party in March by party leader Robert Chakulayi, also known as Bobby Wine, for allegedly receiving 500 million shillings, about $135,000, from President Yoweri Museveni. The party calls this corruption money. However, Mpuuga tells me that the money was legally given to him.
First of all, where does Mr. Museveni get money to dole out to individuals? Does Mr. Museveni own the national currency, the national budget? There's no such thing like going to Mr. Museveni to get money. Mr. Kyagulanyi knows so well, and I challenge him to a public debate so that he can convince people that actually went to Mr. Museveni and takes money. The same way the party leader gets money from the national budget, in the same way, a former leader of the opposition, at the end of his term, was given ex gratia. It is lawful, it was properly processed. He simply wanted to hide his other problems over which I've been challenging him and other leaders in the party, and they don't want to act on them. At one stage you said that I'm corrupt. How you say somebody is corrupt and you do not take them to court or challenge them in court, and you continue, you know, talking about it out of turn, is something I cannot comprehend. But I can tell you and the entire world that it has nothing to do with that money. I know Mr. Chagwanyi and his people close to him so well. I know what they intended to do, which they have not succeeded in doing. They simply desired to character assassinate me because they fear the internal challenge in the party.
Honorable, some people are saying, particularly from the NUP, that you are probably doing the bidding of President Museveni by causing division within the NUP, or that you are being groomed to run for president in 2026. So let's take them first. Are you planning on running for president in 2026?
First of all, who is causing the divisions in the NUP? Who started this whole thing about Matthias Mpuuga eating Mr. Museveni's money? Who started it? Whoever started it actually was interested in retaining NUP as an individual because it doesn't want competition in NUP. And believing that by pushing me out, to be a lone actor. Make no mistake, those who are hounding me know without a shadow of a doubt that I am competent, that actually I'm more competent than them, that actually this country is looking for leaders over the coming years. It could be 2026, it could be beyond. They actually know that in the corridors of power, my name is surfacing. Those who are discussing national politics and leadership have my name on the front pages. So I'm not surprised that their fear is about what I can become, even when I've not announced it. Can I assure you that I am capable of being a presidential candidate and even president? But when it is necessary, and if I think that it's time for me to be part of that platform, I'll announce it. I am not a lone player. I prefer to take decisions after consultation and aware that I have the support of those I work with across. So I cannot apologize for being competent.
Matthias Mpuuga is the former leader of the opposition in Uganda's parliament. He was speaking with us from Kampala. Authorities in northern Nigeria say female suicide bombers have targeted a wedding, a funeral, and a hospital in coordinated attacks that killed at least 18 people. The Associated Press reports that another 30 people were wounded in Sunday's blast. Many of them were seriously injured. No one immediately claimed responsibility for the attacks. Borno State has been heavily affected by Boko Haram extremist insurgency, which has used women and girls in suicide bombings in the past. That has prompted suspicion that some attackers come from the many thousands of people the extremists have kidnapped over the years, including school children. Who will U.S. presidential candidate Donald Trump pick to be his vice presidential running mate? With the Republican National Convention approaching next month, Trump has been mum about his choice, but several contenders have emerged. VOA's Tina Tran tells us each of those prospective running mates brings an opportunity to expand Trump's base of support.
When it comes to vice presidents, Kamala Harris is President Joe Biden's pick this election season. As for presumptive Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump, it's anyone's guess. When pressed for answers, Trump is demurred, saying only that he will announce his choice at the Republican National Convention in July. Among the candidates that have emerged, each brings the chance to broaden Trump's base of supporters. North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum is a top contender. The businessman and entrepreneur built a financial software company that Microsoft purchased in 2001 for over $1 billion. Burgum's wealth and connections would be major assets in helping finance Trump's campaign. And his business experience and know-how aligns with Trump's self-branding as a savvy real estate developer. Fellow Floridian Marco Rubio is another top contender. The state senator has name recognition, with over 25 years of governing experience at the local, state, and national levels. Currently vice chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee and a senior member of the Committee on Foreign Relations, the Cuban-American and Miami native could expand Trump's base of Hispanic and Latino supporters. First-term Ohio Senator J.D. Vance is also thought to be a top contender for VP. The former venture capitalist came to prominence with his 2016 memoir, Hillbilly Elegy, which explored the cultural and socioeconomic decline of the rural white working class. A former Trump critic, Vance once described the former president as reprehensible and called him America's Hitler. He's now a Trump supporter and appeared regularly as a media surrogate during Trump's hush money trial. South Carolina Senator Tim Scott is also in the running for vice president, and if selected, would be the first black Republican on a presidential ticket, potentially broadening Trump's appeal to black Americans. Scott's political career began at the local level in 1995, and he has served in the Senate since 2013. New York Representative Elise Stefanik's name has also surfaced as a possible VP pick. Stefanik considers herself Trump's strongest ally in Congress, where she's the fourth-ranking House Republican leader. Trump's VP pick isn't just about who's best aligned with his priorities, but who will be best positioned to carry them on. If elected again this November, the 78-year-old would be permitted to serve only 4 more years under constitutional term limits for president. Tina Trin, VOA News, New York.
It is time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, James. To begin the sport with football, Nigeria, Kenya and Zambia have learned their group stage opponents for the upcoming FIFA Under 17 Women's World Cup in the Dominican Republic in October following the competition's draw at the weekend. Nigeria, a regular fixture in the tournament, were drawn in Group A alongside host Dominican Republic, Ecuador and New Zealand following the draw. The Flamingos will be looking to improve on their previous performances and make a deep run in the competition. Kenya, making their debut in the tournament, face a challenging Group C. They will compete against North Korea, Mexico and England. Despite being newcomers, the Kenyan side will be eager to make their mark on the global stage. Zambia rounds out the African contingent in Group D, where they will face 2014 champion Japan, Poland and Brazil. The competition kicks off on the 16th of October, with a final scheduled for the 3rd of November in Santo Domingo. This edition marks the last time the competition will host 16 nations, with the 2025 tournament in Morocco expanding to 24 teams. Staying with football news, World Soccer Governing Body FIFA is set to unveil a new normalization committee for the Zimbabwe Football Association. FIFA is to name another committee to run the affairs of ZIFA and replace Lincoln Mutasa's leadership, whose mandate is due to officially expire on June the 30th. The new normalization committee may be unveiled on July the 2nd and will be handed a 9-month tenure to complete the task which Mutasa and his team had set in motion since their July 11th 2023 appointment. ZIFA Chief Executive Yvonne Mwawa said they were still yet to receive official communications from FIFA on the future of the current normalization committee. In athletics, Ese Brume became the first long jumper, male or female, to win 4 titles in the history of the African Athletics Championship, extending her dominance on the continent to a decade since winning her maiden title at the 2014 edition in Marrakesh, Morocco. The African record holder made history in 2018 when she became the first to win 3 consecutive titles in the long jump and was aiming for a 4th title after missing the 2022 edition, and she ultimately delivered. The African record holder was trailing behind defending champion Martha Kuala until her last attempt, when she soared to a distance of 6.73 meters to reclaim her 4th unprecedented gold, narrowly displacing Kuala by 1 centimeter, as the Burkinabe recorded a 6.72 meters jump. Elsewhere in Kenya, the Athletics Integrity Unit, AIU, for the first time banned a Kenyan athlete for life, a female long-distance runner, after she tested positive for banned substances for the 3rd time. AIU handed a 2015 Nagano and 2023 Sofia Marathon champion Beatrice Torotich, who is now 42 years old, a life ban from athletics starting from November the 22nd, 2023. And that's it for this Monday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a very good Monday. And that's it for this Monday, July 1st, edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for beginning your week with us. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I am James Barty in Washington, wishing that you will have a great week.